This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar. Yeah, we are soldiers.
I had to hurry that song choice so I could say it is 9 o'clock straight up. You know how I love to say that. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis in Albany. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, your host Joe Meyer speaks about a discussion about the apartments without parking that are springing up all over Portland. Is this good green growth or a giveaway to developers? The guests are local activist Ruben Doomling and Tamara DeRitter. At 10 o'clock, the guest on Air Cascadia is former CIA officer Ray McGovern. Host Chris Andre will interview him about the prospect of John Brennan at the helm of the CIA. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Kevin Pina reports on a kangaroo court going after former Haitian president John Bertrand Aristide, and Nora Barrows-Friedman presents the weekly report on occupied Palestine from the Electronic Intifada. At 11 o'clock on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen discusses winter pruning and planting.
KBOO is proud to be a media sponsor of An Evening with Dr. Michelle Alexander, Wednesday, January 16th, 2013, from 5 to 9 p.m. at Emmanuel Temple, located at 1033 North Sumner Street. Dr. Alexander is the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. There will be a community fair, a community panel, and Michelle will read from her book. For more info, go to kboo.fm. Into a world I plunge, through my headphones, escaping to the streetlight. I begin to believe in destiny when my
soul. It's been snowing in Afghanistan, and three-year-old Janan died last Friday night, the first to freeze to death this winter in Kabul's ragtag refugee camps. The United States spends $10 billion a month on the Afghan war, a war that Professor Zahair Wahab calls a failure on all fronts. Will we ever leave? What will we leave behind? Join me, Linda Olson-Osterlund, for a deeper look this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. My guest is Dr. Zahair Wahab, back from his work with teacher training in Afghanistan. Tune in to hear his unique and important perspective on Afghanistan 11 years into the war. That's this Thursday morning on a deeper look at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO Community Radio.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Meyer, and this hour-long call-in show is on apartments without parking. We'll start with a brief pre-recorded interview and then meet our in-studio guests. This is a call-in show, and we'll be taking your calls at 503-231-8187. Here's Portland City Planner Bill Cunningham speaking with me at a policy expert group meeting on apartments without parking last December.
The places where we don't require parking, we allow it but don't require it, they're typically in our neighborhood Main Street areas, like Hawthorne or Division or Mississippi. And also, it applies anywhere where there's frequent service transit, so where the bus during the rush hour comes once every 20 minutes. And so those typically tend to be the major streets. And we leave it to the market as to whether they they decide to include parking or not. And while, say, outer East Portland, beyond 82nd, has actually some provisions allowing people to do that kind of development, they aren't, partially because it's not attracting residents who are into the car-free lifestyle. But some of the inner neighborhoods have tended to attract people who are into more of an urban environment and are less concerned about the availability of parking. So yeah, most of the developments being built are inward of about 40th Avenue between 40th and the river and in Northwest Portland.
Do I understand correctly, it's not really a new policy, it's just that the banks are now able to finance these?
Correct. A lot of the policy had been placed since the 1980s. And part of the reason they had those policies back then, it was seen as a way to reinforce community character, because a lot of the old main streets are lined with buildings, and then people were putting in surface parking lots. And at that point, there was a sense that, no, we want to preserve the community character, so let's allow buildings that are like the old ones that don't necessarily have to have parking. And at that point, according to one of our former planning commissioners who was around then, the neighborhoods were in support of that. But of course, the market had not actually responded and built a whole lot according to that, the formula of no parking. And it's only really happened more recently that the rental market's become so hot, and there are a lot of people wanting to live in these walkable neighborhoods. So there's some other issues tied to this, like the scale of development. The four-story buildings coming in, where up to recently there hadn't been any big buildings, but those allowances have been around since the 1920s, and it's more a matter of the market actually now coming to a place where it's feasible to do that development.
Right. And what kind of developments are we seeing there typically? They're four-story, typically smaller apartments?
Yeah, typically it's a four-story building. It's very often on a fairly small site, like what some would consider a double lot, just a 10,000-square-foot site. And one reason why this kind of development is popular in those small sites is if you had a parking requirement, it's really hard to squeeze in both the building and the parking onto a small site. And the allowance to not include it has made it easier to do that kind of development. But, of course, there's a downside. There's community concern about the parking impacts from that development. But it is responding to some priorities we've had where we're wanting to make it easier for more people to live in places that have good access to services. And so making it easier to do development on these small sites has let us help meet that demand. Parking is probably one of the most expensive single components that figure into the cost of housing, especially for higher density housing in small sites.
Right. Some people mentioned that this will prevent families from moving into these areas. Is that a concern of the cities?
We definitely want to create communities that have a mix of all sorts of people and households. So that's a concern of ours. But a lot of these areas actually have still a lot of single family houses. So if you take a division, for example, it's almost all single-family zoning. It's just the narrow band right on the main street that allows higher-density housing. So actually, that's an area where the amount of single-family houses is in excess as a proportion of households that have children. So it really is area-specific. There may not be family housing happening right on the main street, but 100 feet away, it's all single-family houses. So it's definitely a complex issue. Where the difficulty is, it's probably the shortage of affordable family housing. Like, there are a lot of houses near Hawthorne or Division, but they're not affordable anymore. And so that is a concern. How do we get more affordable family-type housing? Because people do feel they've lost the option of living in that area of town if they've got a family of kids.
Some people do think it's like a windfall for developers somehow. I guess just because of market situations, they can take out single-family houses. You know, does the city want to control that in any way or balance that out with neighborhood concerns, or just say, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with making money?
Well, that's why we're having this conversation here, to see where the priorities are. Some people had ideas for, well, maybe we should tie those allowances to providing affordable units or transportation demand management, that's not giving that development opportunity totally away for a developer, but maybe tying it to, well, if you're going to not include parking, you need to do this. You need to be able to make sure you're giving people options to get around, or maybe it should be tied to affordability. That's something brought up by some policy expert group members here, but there'll be more discussion.
Really interesting discussion, especially about kind of the ownership of the right of way. You know, you feel like you do have a right to park in front of your house, and I think it's good to challenge that. I guess.
Sure. Well, we have goals in the city for becoming a city where a lot more people get around by transit, biking, walking. But when you look at internationally, places where there are really high rates of walking and getting around, they're typically not places where you can find parking really readily. So that has to be part of the conversation too. To what extent is our goal to make sure there's always convenient parking in front of along the street versus these goals for having a situation where people are getting around in a whole lot broader ways than they currently do.
That was Portland City Planner Bill Cunningham. The city policy, which allows apartments without parking, has been in effect for decades, and only recently has the rental market made such developments financially feasible. You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Meyer, and we're talking about apartments without parking. I'm joined live in Studio 2 by citizen activist Tamara DeRitter. Welcome, Tamara.
Good morning.
And Ruben Däumling.
Hi.
This is a call-in show, and the phone lines are now open at 503-231-8187. Tamara, can you say a few words about your background and involvement in apartment parking?
Well, I'm a land use planner by trade. I've been a planning director in four different cities, and I'm currently the co-chair of my land use and transportation committee for our neighborhood. I got involved because the citywide land use group, and I represent my neighborhood at that, they decided to have a task force pulled together, and I've led up that group to try to open up the conversation with various people in the community and bring this topic back to the city as a full banquet of issues rather than just one topic, such as, you know, we don't want apartments or we do want apartments. So, you know, it's a much more complex
issue. Definitely a complex issue. Mm-hmm. And Ruben, what's your interest in involvement in apartments without parking in Portland here?
So I'm first and foremost a citizen who's interested in anything to do with transportation, especially as it relates to climate change policy. I am a member of the 1/7 of Multnomah County households who don't own a car. I am also the president of the Sunnyside Neighborhood Association, for whom I am not speaking here today for the board or the neighborhood, but I have gotten interested in the issues through that position. And most recently, I served on the task force that focused on this subject that Tamara chaired.
Great. Well, I think Bill Cunningham brought up several interesting points. I was surprised to hear that this policy was originally instated to preserve neighborhood character. Tamara, do you have anything to say?
Well, my understanding is the Belmont Business Association was very excited about making sure they didn't have gap tooth development. And a lot of the suburban type development was moving back in 20 years ago, and they didn't want it. So they supported apartments with no parking in order to make sure that they had street frontage development.
Right. You don't want to see a parking lot along Belmont. You
exactly.
Right. And that's historically not how it's been developed.
Right.
Well, listeners, are there new developments in your neighborhood without parking? Do you think you have the right to park in front of your house? Is this an issue best left to the housing market? Give us a call and let us know. The phone lines are open at 503-231-8187. What do you think, Ruben? How does this fit into the Portland plan?
Well, I think the Portland Plan is a huge document that I'm not particularly qualified to speak to in the general sense, but I think this issue, like many others, but perhaps even more so, is really a dynamic problem that touches on so many pieces of how we choose to live together, how we struggle living together on close quarters. And I think that certainly to the extent that climate change is bearing down on both the Portland Plan and this issue, there are a lot of links, a lot of issues, a lot of dimensions that we should be mindful of in the sense that this is a dynamic problem, that it is not static. None of the pieces are really static. Car ownership rates, for one, are in flux in interesting ways that we can talk about perhaps later. But I think many people's approach to this issue that I've been aware of are more static than I think really does justice to the issue.
Great. Tamara, anything to add to that in terms of like the Portland plan or livability in general?
Well, the Portland plan has a lot of aspirational goals about livability and environmental context and balance on the ground. The reality is people need their cars and need to, you know, pick up their elders and get them to a place of doctor's appointment. And right now, it's not feasible for a whole lot of folks just to jump onto a bike and get to and from where they need to go. So the Portland plan is aspirational. But where I live is the reality of we're not there yet, and we need to have attraction rather than promotion when we're talking about these grand ideas. And it's just not, you know, having no car is not a reality for many of the Portlanders right now.
Right. It's definitely a balancing act. Well, we do have a caller on the line. Jack, what do you have to say now?
Well, I've lived all over the world in many places where people live in close, congested kind of apartments squeezed together and stuff, various cities in Europe and Asia. And but still, there are some people who need to have vehicles, one kind or another. I'd prefer to live without a vehicle, but I need my pickup truck to do my work. So it's there. My wife needs her car to do her job. She has to run all over town to about sometimes as many as 8 or 10 locations a day to do on-site interpreting. Some people are tied to that. There's just no way. And some people want cars, okay? So if you're going to have congested, the one thing you notice in Europe and Asia, in cities that are crowded where and streets are narrow, and streets aren't so narrow here, but the more parking we get on the streets, we get specific problems. And what you don't see here, what you do see there everywhere, are intersection mirrors. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No. Can you explain that, please?
Well, these are very common in Europe. You come to an intersection, and you know the problem I'm talking about. You're trying to get in through that intersection onto to a larger road or whatever, and you can't see the cars coming right from either side because there's so many cars parked on the street. So you have to edge your way into the street. And then you take your brake, take a dash, and sometimes someone gets ticked off at you or whatever, and sometimes there might be a fender bender. Very common in Europe, at such a kind of an intersection, there's one right at the end of my street. It's a T intersection to a busier street. And in Europe, there would be a convex mirror sitting at on a pole at that street, and on that mirror you can see then the cars. It is focused in such a way that as you come to the intersection you can see cars coming and going. You don't have to pull into the middle of the intersection to actually see them.
Right. Sounds great, Jack. Let's see if our studio guests want to comment on that. What about solutions from other cities?
Well, just on his comment, I think it would be a great asset, especially for pedestrians, because one of the issues that has come up in our meetings is the more congested on-street parking becomes, the less safe people crossing the street is. And so convex mirrors would not only help the drivers, but the pedestrians.
Great. I think we got another caller on the line. Eugene, what do you think about apartments and no parking in Portland?
Well, first of all, thanks for having this show. I really appreciate it that we get to discuss this. The point that I'd like to bring up is one I haven't read about, and that's there are a lot of us who've owned our houses for a long time and lived in Portland for a long time who are approaching 65 or older, and we'd like to age in place. And that's going to be harder and harder to do if it's like Northwest 21st and Everett and you have to walk 6 blocks to your car to get your groceries. And I just wonder if that's in the mix at all for people considering the fact that you want to, a mix of ages as well as incomes and everything else. Thanks.
That's an excellent point, Eugene. Anyone hear much about that, Ruben?
Your example is interesting to me about 21st and Everett and the groceries. My suspicion would be, and I'm not going to say that this is true for everyone, but within 6 blocks, you probably would be at your groceries, actually, rather than the car. I think some of the advantages of these transit corridors in the inner parts of our city is that, at least in principle, a lot of the kinds of things that people might in other places feel they need to drive to, they wouldn't actually have to drive to. That's sort of the point. Now, whether that works in practice as well as on paper is an open question. But I think that in theory, the fact that these buildings are specifically allowed on high-use transit corridors is a crucial piece here. The other thing I would want to say about the prior caller who's talking about having two cars, one of the things that to me is so interesting and dynamic about this problem is that most people I've encountered at the city and just private citizens don't appreciate that one quarter of all renter households in this county don't have a car right now. So it's less, I think, as some people would have it, about convincing those of us with cars to give up our cars. It's perhaps an acknowledgement that right now, I think of it as an acknowledgement, whether the city sees it that way, I don't know, of the fact that a fairly sizable portion of the demographic we're talking about, these are apartments for rent, don't have a car. Now, they, of course, aren't automatically going to move into these apartments and therefore make the problem go away. But looked at in that way, I think we could appreciate that it may be less of a zero-sum game than some people think.
But I really think his point about aging in place is very critical. And it may be that we need to look at different types of shuttles. We need to look at different means of collective travel or making sure that people in these situations have groceries and not, you know, food deserts.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think I'd maybe add a small point that the rates at which households in Multnomah County own cars are historically very high, high relative to the rest of the world, and they are going down. In fact, right now, if you look at the 2000 statistics and the 2010 statistics, the car ownership rates are declining.
But that is only for Portland.
That's only for Portland, but we're also talking about Portland.
Well, I know, but I'm saying that, and also it's much more exaggerated in Southeast Portland, where 25% right. Don't own a car. Right. So just one size does not fit all.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right. Well, it seems like these no parking apartments are on current mass transit lines. Can we predict what mass transit will look like in 5 or 10 years? Or is there something?
Well, you know, it's hard to know what TriMet's mindset is these days because they keep on cutting services. Right. And they have the hardest time with their union. So everything points to that they're going to decrease services. I do not know if there's a way to get an additional type of service in place other than TriMet. I would encourage and have encouraged planning to be linked with transit. And right now, they're their own agency, and they work at their own drum.
Right.
Beat.
Well, I've got another two-minute piece from that policy expert group. Here's Portland planner Matt Wickstrom from last December's
great
meeting.
The Bureau of Planning and Sustainability conducted a great deal of research and analysis. One thing that we did was we contracted with David Evans and Associates to do what we were calling a parking and travel behavior study. What they did was looked at 8 existing infill apartment projects, 2 of those are condos, with either little or no parking. They surveyed the residents of those buildings to find out about their parking and travel behavior and their vehicle ownership as well. And that was really a key point. We heard developers quoting a real range of what they expected car ownership to be among residents of the building. And so one of the purposes for the survey was to try to get a better sense on really, do residents of buildings without parking own cars? And then if so, how? What percentage do? They also did parking utilization studies, basically looking at a 2-block area around each building to see what the rate of parking congestion is on those streets. They conducted more in-depth interviews with some of the residents as well as with some of the stakeholders in the community. And then they also compiled research that's out there. Part of what they're finding was with the compilation of research is there's not a lot of research about multi-dwelling projects and parking. We also wanted to get a sense of what the cost of providing parking was because we heard from developers that adding a parking adding parking to a building would take a $700 a month apartment and turn it into a $1,200 a month apartment. And so we wanted to see ground truth that. We looked at TriNet service and to see if the places where these upcoming buildings are located are vulnerable to service cuts. And then finally, we looked at building, did some building permit research over the last 6 years.
That was Portland City Planner Matt Wickstrom. I did invite the Portland Sustainability Department to come, and they couldn't make it due to impending meeting tomorrow, I guess. We heard Matt Wickstrom mention that a parking space makes a $700 parking apartment to a $1,200 apartment. What does that mean to you, Ruben?
It dovetails with my understanding of the capital costs and the differential costs of building a building with and without some kind of off-street parking. But what I don't know, and I think maybe we would do well to know more about, is whether and to what extent the developers pass on those savings to their renters, because it is entirely possible that in a tight renting market, they say, oh, well, that was very nice to save all that money, but we know that we can charge the full market rate as if it were a parking.
And that is exactly what we found out by looking at the eight apartment complexes in the traffic study done by the city of Portland. It was the apartments that did not have parking that were the most expensive.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you're talking about, is it, you know, it is the market.
Right.
You know, it's the market that dictates how expensive these units are. Whether they have parking or not doesn't really seem to matter in most cases.
Yeah. One other dimension of that, of course, that has less to do with the pricing, which is very important and I think an interesting issue to think more about, is the sense that planners have, well, some architects, planners who've written letters on this issue to the city around the extent to which the buildings and the sidewalk and the street can communicate with each other, and to the extent to which having off-street parking can sometimes frustrate that attempt to have the street work together in a dynamic way that they understand well or claim to understand well.
Right, great. Well, phone lines are open at 503-231-8187. Are there new developments in your neighborhood without parking? Do you want to park in front of your house? Do you think you have the right to? Is it best to leave it up to the market? What do you think? Give us a call, 503-231-8187. Has there been much talk about a neighborhood-by-neighborhood solution? We talk about every neighborhood is different.
yeah, there's a million different solutions out there, and all of them have some validity based on where they're, what their situation is. Right now, down in Division Street Hardware is just going crazy because there are all these apartments being built, and they can't even find parking for the owner, you know, on the street. And there's not a place nearby where they can have an off-street parking space. So existing businesses are being pushed out. And that's not the ideal here. We want to make sure that we have vibrant businesses stay, especially hardware stores. you know, you don't want to be traveling from Home Depot with massive amounts of stuff on a bicycle.
Right.
So.
One thing that I think does dovetail with the idea of a neighborhood-based approach, perhaps, is something called a parking benefit district, which was mentioned in an editorial in the Oregonian this week. And I don't know how much we want to go into the details of that, but it's an interesting kind of solution that is different from the typical kinds of approaches to managing parking that we're used to, where the funds generated by charging non-residents for parking are plowed back into the neighborhood itself.
I see. Yeah, we definitely don't want to encourage people to get in their car, and I can see how that may backfire.
Another idea that a guy named Shoup had recommended is for block by block people, the residents getting together and saying, we want to pay $12 into an agreement that will have overnight parking just for the residents.
I see.
And that way, if there's an apartment complex that is a block away, they can't come in and park on that particular street.
So that's a parking sticker idea, something
right.
like that.
Exactly.
Well, we do have another caller on the line. Steve, what's your take on the issue?
Well, I've lived in all different neighborhoods of Portland, and the thing that really determines the price is what part of the city that the apartments are in. For example, the most expensive apartments are in Northwest Portland by far, and none of those have parking, but it's been that way for decades.
Right.
I live east of Gateway now, where the rents are a lot less, and almost all the apartments out here do have parking. You know, they're pretty. They've been here for decades. The apartments, and the lots have always been here. So it seems to me that this problem is really only predominating in downtown and northwest. I think all the other parts of the city, there's plenty of parking. So it's not really a major concern, I would say, at this point.
I see. For most, but I guess along Hawthorne and Division, we're starting to see that problem.
I would say about from 50th Avenue inward.
Right.
Well, there's good transit in those areas, though, and if it's on the major transit corridor, I still don't think it's a problem. I think it's a goal that we should work towards with less car ownership. But I just don't think that right now in the outlying areas it's enough of a problem to be a major concern for residents, it seems to me.
I agree.
So it's leave it up to the market is kind of your take on it then, Steve?
Well, yeah, I think the city should encourage less car ownership and more dense development, but it just seems to me that the things are going that way anyway, according to the market.
Great. We got a couple more callers on the line. Thanks for your call, Steve. Cindy, what's your take on the issue?
Well, I have to disagree with Steve. I live in Northeast, and we just had our first building built two blocks from me that has no parking. And previously, I live in an apartment on a corner. My building has three parking spots for four units, and I'm the unit that doesn't have any parking, so I park on the street. I used to be able to park on the side facing that building. I'm very lucky in this parking way in that the corner is blocked. You can't drive through. So I used to be able to park on that street. I can't any longer. The street that you can't get to easily from where that building is, I can still park there.
Great. Well, Sandy,
let me just say, our little area has been able to absorb one building. I think the issue will be when the next one is built.
I see.
They did a survey, and I can't remember if it was 67 or 76% of the people who live in these buildings have cars. It's a fantasy that not giving people cars will make them use transit. They do use transit, but they want a car when they go to the grocery store.
Sure.
So the car is parked there even more.
Right.
And
well,
to add to that, we heard from the city of Portland in their study that about 70% of those people with in apartment complexes do own a car, at least one.
Exactly. And so these people have cars, they just don't have a parking place.
Right.
And in this fantasy of the city that by not giving parking, people won't have cars is just that. It's just wishful thinking.
I'll say a little bit about that. I think it may appear to be a fantasy, and I'm not in any way minimizing the fact that perhaps many of these buildings do seem to have that ratio of car ownership per unit, and that's a problem. I would completely agree that's the problem. There seems to be some disagreement about some of these buildings, but anyway, about how many cars they have. But I think I want to stress that we have now fairly new three different organizations in this city that cater to people through cars that they don't have to own themselves. There's Get Around, where you can rent your neighbor's car. There is Zipcar, and there's now Car2Go. All of them are growing, by my understanding, quite rapidly in popularity, and it does take time for people to get used to the idea of not having their own car and the advantages, actually, of using these other cars that they don't need to be responsible for. And my understanding is that is a very dynamic piece of this issue that is going to, I can't see how it would not change the equation. Now, whether that reduces it to 50% or 30% and over what time, I can't say.
Well, I am what they call a senior citizen, and if I have to walk 5 minutes from my parking place to my house, carrying my stuff, I'm going to have to move.
Right. Again,
good point. And, if they build one more of these near me, and obviously it's zoned apartments, it's going to be impossible, and who's going to want to buy my place? You know, it's a lot more complicated than how much transit. I have a bus pass, but I need my car sometimes.
Well, Sandy, thanks for the call. It's really bringing up an important point. There's no one-size-fits-all for sure. Let's go back to the phone lines. Rose, what's your take on this issue?
Well, I think that, there was one thing that you guys said that in meetings, the talk of the interview, or was mentioning is that they, talked to developers, and developers were saying, that you would take a $500 a month or $700 a month apartment, and if you added parking, it would be $1,200. And I just want to say this specifically on this one thing, because I have a lot of other things I think about it, but on one thing that I think we miss is that that's not really a viable argument, because the city of Portland was built with some houses having parking and some houses having no parking, all being built in the early 1900s, which we really want to save our neighborhoods and not tear down a lot of our houses. So that worked okay, and with the advancement of technology and just different ways and lifestyles, you can't just go on what a developer says it's going to cost, because the cost of living in an apartment in any major city in the world is going to go up unless you have rent control like they do in New York City, because it will make it unaffordable. It also makes it a little bit harder to live if you're an older person. We do get along. We do get along on that. But, having somebody, a developer, sit in a room with the city and saying, well, it will make these unaffordable. Well, they're going to get unaffordable. You can take a house price from the river on the east side going for $475 and up, and as you get out past 50th, it will start to go down. And it's just going to go up. And it also costs more money for insurance for people that have cars that don't have off-street parking. That is a rule. That is something that they do. The insurance is higher. Everything. Mm-hmm. So to sit with a developer with that argument, I think it's very weak at best. A weak argument that this is going to cost more money, because inevitably those people without the parking in those apartments, their rent's going to go up. Trust me.
Yeah, I agree with you, Rose. I think rents are going to be market driven, and I'm not sure why the city would parrot that. Thanks so much for the call. Let's get back to the phone lines. Tori, what's your take on this issue?
Hey, okay, so I just wanted to respond, I guess, to the fellow who was talking about the fact that
I think we lost her. No problem. Who else do we have then? Tim, what's your take on the issue?
Just a couple of things. One, I think when you say that car ownership is going down, I don't think that's necessarily a voluntary number. I think the fact is that we are getting further and further apart from being able to afford different items, including a car. So if you actually wanted to do a effective study, you'd have to look at the people who would have a car if they could afford it. And I think what you're finding is a lot of young people just no longer can afford a car. And so it's not a choice of, gee, I'm going to be on a bike or a skateboard my whole life. They just can't afford a car because of the job situation in the city. Is the wages are not keeping up with the costs.
That's true, too.
So I think you need to keep that in mind. The other point is this city is heavily influenced by developers. I mean, I think City Hall pretty much runs off of the dictates of a few people like Homer Williams, who is standing on the platform of our mayor when he got elected, and that a lot of these decisions are not made off of so-called strategic planning. They're made off of people trying to make a profit. And the profit goes up hugely when you build cheap apartments with no parking. These things are going to last. These aren't like the old apartments that last forever. These things are built like CRAP. And they're going to be, in 20 years from now, they're going to be a blight in their neighborhood. I just think it's totally unrealistic that you're kind of mixing some sort of a planning mechanism to try to force people into a lifestyle they don't really want to have, and the people that are profiting from it are all living in a very car-driven world. I just think there's a bit of absurdity going on.
Great points. I think Ruben wants to respond to that.
Yeah, three quick points on the car rate of car ownership. One that would suggest that there's a little more to it than you were acknowledging is that the rate at which younger people, 16 to 34, are getting car licenses, not buying cars, getting licenses at all, is dropping quite substantially relative to older cohorts. Secondly, in Multnomah County, 6% of homeowners don't have a car. Now, we don't know a whole lot about who those people are and how voluntary that was, but at least it would seem to take out of the equation a common assumption, right or wrong, that it is the poor renters who can't afford cars. There's a little bit more going on. And thirdly, and vastly more dynamically, is the question of the future of the car, quite apart from our apartment conversation. It's not entirely clear to me that we can just assume, because for a century we've had cars, that that won't change in the future. So I think it's a totally separate dimension, but I think it's not something we should leave out of the equation. And there is a climate action plan that the city has passed, that it is working toward complying with. There's a lot of dynamic aspects to that that also bear on this question of not forcing people out of their cars, as some people would put it, but of acknowledging the fact that the rate at which we have gotten used to using and owning cars is perhaps over. And not because somebody wants to shove an unpalatable policy down someone else's throat, but because it's just the reality.
I disagree. I think that the use of a vehicle is not over. And whether it is a gas-powered or diesel-powered car, that is up to question. I think we're in the bloom of electric vehicles. Right. And whether or not that's a two-seater, one-seater, whatever vehicle, we're looking at maybe a change in that dynamic. But I do not think cars are in that sense of a vehicle.
Right.
Are going away, because people still need to get around.
Sure, but I think I would back off and say, so sure, it's a matter of rate. Do we have 1.1 cars per person or per adult or per everybody in this country, or might be pare back to 0.5 or 0.6? And I think in some places we just plain already are paring back to that.
Right, it's interesting. We have to try to predict the future in many ways. You have to predict the future of car ownership, of TriMet and so forth, and demand for these parkings. Let's get back to the phone lines. Here's Tori. Sorry we lost you earlier. Thanks for calling back.
Oh yeah, totally. So I guess I just wanted to, like I was saying, respond to the fellow who was talking about how this might not be an issue. This is a non-issue for people who live in the outskirts of the city. Well, basically, so my concern is that as people in the city use TriMet less from the budget cuts that TriMet was experiencing recently, you know, it becomes a more unreliable service. And the first thing that gets cut, aside from longer times between routes, is routes that go to the outskirts of the city that aren't used as often. And the primary people who need to use those routes are people who are disabled, who are elderly, who work in the city, who don't have any other way of getting here. And I guess that's something that we should, I just want to bring that up and think about how that's something that we should maybe be considering when we talk about this issue, because it's not just something that affects wealthy inner city people who probably don't need to drive to the grocery store anyway and can walk there.
Yep.
So,
also, it's a class issue. Those people who have enough money for a car, they will always have a car. And those people who do not will be forced to use transit and use up 3 hours of their time trying to get to and from work.
Right. And if we could encourage people in the city to support public programs, like, well, not that TriMet is a public program, but programs that benefit people who might otherwise not, you know, might be disabled in some way, then I think that it would encourage a better system for all of us. And so I don't think that we should be so concerned with people necessarily, you know, losing the right to drive their cars as much as, I don't know. That's just my concern.
I completely agree. And I think transit access for vulnerable populations, if you want to call them that, is a huge, huge issue and one that deserves more attention. I completely agree with what you said.
Yeah,
great. Well, Tori, thanks so much for the call. Let's get back to the lines. Joe's on the line. Hey, Joe.
Good morning. As density increases, livability decays. I mean, you can talk to any laboratory specialist who is growing lab rats. If you cram too many of them in there in one spot, they start to kill and eat each other. So the same thing happens with humans. I mean, look at anywhere around the country, around the world, when you have real high-density housing and then have the frustration of, like, the one elderly lady that was talking about there, where she had to walk 2 or 3 or 5 minutes just to get to her car carrying her groceries and stuff. That doesn't make for a good life, and people become hostile. They have a, you know, not quite a sunny, bright mood as they normally would have. So these crooks and shysters that are back Charlie Hale's part of the Home Builders Association in the area, they don't care about, I mean, these are conservative Republicans who basically just want to take all of the underlings, the peons, and shove them into these little cracker boxes, and they don't care if you've got to spend 3 hours on public transit getting back and forth to your job or to where you need to go get your food or your medicine or your doctor visit or whatever.
Great points, Joe. Let's let Ruben respond to that. Thanks for the call.
I'm going to just speak to the idea of the rats in the lab. Cities the world over have densities that are higher than Portland. I think actually I've heard that LA's density is actually higher per mile than Portland's. I'm not sure about that, but that's what I've heard. I think that it's really important to understand that we here in Portland and in many U.S. cities that are not particularly dense, haven't historically been very dense, have been built up around the automobile, are unused to, can't imagine what it would be like to live in slightly more dense places. No one is talking about Singapore here or Hong Kong. And I think that we will find out, as we are finding out, that slight increases in density, unevenly distributed though they may be, actually don't cause lab rat conditions, and that we rise to the occasion.
And also, studies have found that Paris, which has a height limit to their structures, actually has the same density as New York City. So it's how you use that space is the most important, and how we get accustomed to maybe tighter spaces together. Right now, I mean, I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee. The common space is usually about 1.5 feet, and in Portland, it's about 2 feet, you know, when you talk to people. So every different community has its different social space. And as we're, again, this cannot happen overnight, but as we get more dense, the likelihood is that space will get smaller. And our needs for space will get smaller.
All right. Well, our ex-mayor used to like to talk about 20-minute neighborhoods, but a lot of these apartments don't really require commercials. So if you just have housing, that seems like that's not enough. Let's get back to the phone lines. John, what's your take on this issue?
I live, first of all, I'm classified supposedly as a senior citizen. I'm 69. I have a home in Southeast. We've cut down to one automobile instead of two, but I have to drive both my wife to her pickup and my daughter to her school, which is on the west side. But I have lived also in San Francisco and New York City, and the real problem which the Portland leadership doesn't address is the fundamental structure of the city. We are a concentric city. We're not like San Francisco. We're not like Manhattan. We're not all jammed into a small place. People have to drive many miles sometimes to work, 20, 30 miles sometimes, 40 miles. The kind of changes they're trying to put forth, I mean, I've also lived in Montreal briefly. There are cities working on the public transport structure, connecting all the rail lines together. These are projects that have to go on for 50 years. It'll take a long time to change it. But building shoddy housing, I think it's right that the citizenry wants to keep the lifestyle that we've had. I mean, we are not Hong Kong. We are not New York. We are not San Francisco. We're a Western city that was set up on this grid planning mode with lots of space. And we've also got many new technologies coming in which have to do with electric transport. I think in 50 years we'll probably have vehicles which are 75% lighter. We haven't really gotten, the automobile always trails the airplane by about 50 years. You know, we have, World War II airplanes.
Well, that's some good points, John. Let's let Ruben
and
respond.
What I'm trying to say is that these transitions are going to have to be very slow, and I think the more back talk that the planners get from the city. I mean, I'm so disgusted with the planning, everything from the bridge that they didn't adjust the height to the bioswales, which it's a very strange thing, because the citizenry, there's a disconnect between the citizenry and the city and the planners. That's all I'm really going
to
say.
Well, thanks, John. There's a lot to work on, no doubt. Let's get back to the phone lines. John again.
Hello.
John, thanks for calling.
Do you hear me?
We hear you good.
Okay. I've been taking notes as I've been listening to all this, and then kind of where do they all root back to? And the root to me appears to be that we have this mentality of an entitlement to entertainment. And, you know, we go to our jobs, a lot of us, and when we get off, we just want to blank out and get into, you know, some form of entertainment. But yet, we don't like what's going on. And so when the city council decided they were going to put parking meters in Washington Park and at the zoo, I started digging in a little bit about, you know, how are they able to do this without my input? And the answer that I got was that, well, that's the person that I voted for that office, and within that office, that's the architecture of their power set, that they can get together and do that without consulting me, being the populace. And I hear a lot of what people are saying, and I think what we need to get back to is we need to start reassessing the power that we've given people in city council.
No doubt. That's definitely a larger issue. Let's let our guests respond to that. How's the process been, or is there a way for John to get involved?
I think he's not too late to get involved. There's two things that are going on right now in response to our issues being raised about apartments with no parking. One is the city has pledged to do a short fix to try to address some of the most egregious issues that are happening in the close-in neighborhoods. The second thing is get yourself involved in the comprehensive plan update. We're just about ready to open up the doors and look at the policies that are being crafted by the city. I urge you to attend those open houses because it's legislative and everybody needs to be involved.
Right. Back to the phone lines then. Tomas.
Hi. I was calling to talk about a little bit about the quality of living stuff regarding higher densities. I lived in Mexico City for 3 years, and I think that Mexico City has about twice the density that Portland does. But I shortly before I left there several years ago, I read a statistic that 30% of the area of Mexico City was covered by road, which is, I imagine, having lived there and having lived here in a bunch of other places, is probably pretty similar all over the place.
Right.
Even though the number of cars is so much higher there and so on and so forth. But that got me to thinking that, you know, reducing the amount of roadway really increases our space. I mean, it's pretty absurd to think that 30% of any given area would be reserved almost exclusively for private automobile use. I don't drive a car. I have friends that do. Sometimes I do use cars. They're very useful things, but I feel like we give way too much space to cars in general, and I know that's something that will change over time with a whole lot of different initiatives, a whole lot of different ways of reducing the number of cars. That, of course, includes vastly improving public transportation all around. But reducing that the amount of roadway that there are, you know, we can turn those into green spaces. We can turn them into parks.
I wholly agree with you. You know, we have so much more asphalt than we can afford to maintain. It really is true.
And it's incredibly expensive as well.
Yeah. I would say I agree with you also. But I think one issue that both the caller two callers ago and you are touching on, I think, is in part captured by this idea of a parking benefit district, which on the one hand is very simple. On the other hand, may get into some technical details about how you allocate certain things. But I think in some ways, we, without changing anything, I've talked a lot about how dynamic this problem is. The one thing that one could do that would, in one stroke, deal with at least the issue of not finding enough space for parking would be a parking benefit district. And maybe there'll be a future show on that.
Right. Well, so let's bring it back in studio. We're done with the phone lines. Thanks, everyone, for calling. So according to the city and developers, there's going to be basically a $500 a month windfall for developers.
And what I'd like to say, instead of it being a windfall for developers, they should pony up that money and put it into some means of attracting non-car owners in that those rental units. Because right now, they have the minimum amount of parking space for bicycles, and they don't do anything else to attract folks without cars.
And I would say, beyond attract, incentivize or subsidize. I mean, same idea, right. But maybe even a little bit stronger. That I had not previously appreciated the degree to which, perhaps, as we're learning here, that money is just plain going into the pockets of the developers.
Right.
And to the extent that that's true, and it sounds like it is, absolutely. I mean, if that money is just sitting there, and we could help to solve this problem by moving the population that currently doesn't have a car into these apartments, helping them to decide that, subsidizing them, reducing the rents, you know, having some kind of stipulation that says, well, you know, you can't be more than 70% above median rate if you claim to be catering to this public, et cetera.
I see. Is there a way to do that beyond besides rent control? Can you subsidize TriMet? Is there some way, some specific ideas we can do with that? $500 a month, that's a lot of money.
Oh, it's enormously. Yes. Enormous. I mean, TriMet subsidies are a sort of an obvious windfall to TriMet.
on-street parking for share cars. You know,
right.
certain ways in which you can work with the existing right. space.
Increasing right. the density of the car sharing institutions that we currently have.
And expanding them. You know, there's a lot of off-street parking that cannot be rented out, such as in the residential areas, driveways, whatever else. They currently, it's illegal to rent those spaces out. It's okay in commercial areas, but you cannot in right. private areas.
A lot of good solutions. What's City Hall going to do next on this issue? What's happening next at City Hall?
Well, we have a City Hall meeting on this topic tomorrow at 2:00.
Tomorrow, too. Is it going to be a good thing for people to come out to? Or
I would say it's going to be they're giving only 1 hour for this topic, but I think it's a very important issue, and they have not discussed this particular issue as yet.
Tomorrow, 2 o'clock, a lot of great ideas out there. That's all we have time for. Ruben, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Tamara, thank you so much.
This edition of Political Perspectives was produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. Special thanks to Christine Yoon for production help. This program was made possible by KBOO members. Thank you, members. I'm your host, Joe Meyer, and Sisyphus is happy.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis in Albany. The time is 9:58. Coming up at 10 o'clock, your guest on Air Cascadia is former CIA officer Ray McGovern. Host Chris Andre will interview him about the prospect of John Brennan at the helm of the CIA. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Kevin Pina reports on a kangaroo court going after former Haitian president John Bertrand Aristide.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, January 9th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. John Brennan is now the administration's strongest advocate of extrajudicial killing of U.S. citizens by drones. And Ray McGovern, former CIA alumni himself, is the left's strongest advocate of questioning Brennan until he squeaks. Even though election season's over, the fundraising juggernaut continues to bowl along through Salem. Legislators are heading into the 2013 session, and already the drumbeat has begun. In Syria and across the Middle East, John Brennan's rise to the upper echelons of power raising concerns. But first, the weather. Showers, highs near 45, southwest winds today, around 16 miles per hour, gusting possibly up to 25. Tonight, look for more rain and low around 35. Temperatures dropping all across the bioregion. And wind dropping off, though. And tomorrow, we got more rain and showers throughout the day, but wait, there's more. Snow level drops to 500 feet. Partly sunny with a high near 42. Thursday night, tomorrow night, slight chance of rain. And again, snow levels hovering around that 500 foot level with a low around 32. The alternative forecast pretty much holding steady. We've got a waning crescent leaf moon in Scorpio, 27 days old. And basically, this is a time for garden maintenance. And we are in Scorpio, it's a water sign. And in generally speaking, planting, germination, strong, sturdy growth. But don't expect too much right now. And that's it. That's it for the forecast, both conventional and the alternative. And we are very fortunate this morning to welcome Ray McGovern. He has been an outspoken gadfly and has consistently taken to task those who would assume power and abuse the rule of law and expect to get away, no questions asked, simply because that's the way they've been playing it for such a long time. Again, it's the cult of American exceptionalism. This John Brennan, President Obama's choice for the top slot at the CIA, has openly advocated